on and get started with a presentation from our Revenue Officer, Paul Warner. I think we will go till about 1:50, 1:55 today is our ETA for departure.
Okay. Mr. Chair, as you recall, on our schedule that we have laid out for orientation, today is really an overview of the revenue situation. There's more focus on the current situation than we would normally have, obviously because of the urgency and the dramatic change in our revenue stream over the last couple of years. And then tomorrow we'll begin a detailed discussion of the personal income tax, Thursday followed by a discussion of the property tax. And then on Friday, you're invited to the House Revenue Committee meeting at 8:30 for the Revenue Options Task Force. What I've done on this overview section is really divided into three categories and three time periods, really. The first is what I call the prelude to our current revenue situation, and I've called the current situation a revenue crunch. And then the aftermath is the 03-05 budget that you're planning now and will be working on throughout the session. But I think really to get a full understanding of our in context for our current situation, we need to look back at the 90s and see some of the changes that have taken place. Some of them were pretty subtle, and others were pretty dramatic. The three main forces affecting our revenue stream in the 1990s were Measure 5, then to a lesser extent Measure 50, which had more effect on our future property tax growth. Then what I call the search for alternative revenue, which took place in this building, but also took place in City Hall and county government throughout the state. And we'll see how that manifests itself really in increased use of non-tax revenue sources. The other overriding force throughout the period was the economic boom. And the economic boom was really unprecedented in terms of its stock market increases. We saw the Dow Jones increase over 20% 3 years in a row, and that had never happened. So it was an unprecedented boom in equity prices.
So, Paul, what were the top two or three the alternative revenue sources that local... do we have two or three that were the...
Mr. Chair, we have... I'll show you in a minute one of overheads that looks at the census categories, and you can see the biggest growth was in charges for local government. And there's a whole assortment of charges, including sewer development charges, system development charges, recreation charges. So that's where we saw the rapid growth in the non-tax side. I think this is a chart really that has numerous implications. It shows you, first of all, that really with the beginning of Measure 5 here in 1991, Oregon's property tax burden, relatively speaking, compared to other states, was very high, fifth in the country as a percent of our personal income. So we were a high property tax state at that time. Measure 5 came into place with the 1990 elections, implemented in 91. And notice that even though there was a lot of disappointment on the part of residential property owners during this period about the property tax relief they thought they were going to get, and many people didn't because assessed values increased so rapidly, because this also occurred at the peak of the California in-migration. But nonetheless, all those forces aside, property tax collections dropped 12% over this period. And that drop all occurred in school taxes. Because remember, what Measure 5 did was phase in the maximum school rate down to $5 per thousand. And if you look back prior to Measure 5, it was about $18 per thousand statewide average, including high rates in eastern Oregon, for example, as well as in some of the metropolitan areas of the state. So property taxes were falling significantly.
If we were to... adjust the Measure 5 limit for inflation, what would it be right now? Seven bucks a thousand? Do you have any look at that?
Senator Ringo, remember that Measure 5 was a rate limit, so that
right.
you almost had an automatic inflation adjustment once it was in place because it was a rate limit, and then if value grows, rates the same, revenue would have grown the same rate as value.
Yeah, okay.
And that's,
you're right.
But
you're
now,
right.
I think your question pertains more to Measure 50. That puts a 3% limit on existing property. And so if you look at overall market values, they've been growing around 6%.
Mm-hmm.
So you're knocking about 3% off statewide on average on what normally would be value growth.
Thank you.
You can also see kind of some of the explanation for some of the votes we had and voter reaction. Here's Measure 5, $5 limit reached. First year under Measure 5, remember Measure 5, no value constraint, property taxes increased 12%. And those bills were in people's mailboxes in late October of 96, and on the November ballot was Measure 47. There's probably no.
So is that all due to assessments?
This was due to assessed value growth, yes.
And that's what gave you the 12.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, residential property throughout the 90s was growing 10 to 12% a year. Okay. We had, you know, if you go back to 1990 and look at our residential property, we're clearly out of line with the West Coast. California and Washington had much higher prices. And all parts of the state. I mean, it's occurring southern Oregon, the coast, central Oregon, as well as the metro areas.
Okay.
But you can also see the immediate effect of the rollback provision in Measure 50 knocks off about 2% here. And then here's the limiting growth of the value limits under Measure 50 of, we think, about 5% a year. And kind of the rule of thumb we've used, 3% existing property, 2% exception value, which is predominantly new construction. This past year, with a recession in effect, we've seen value growth statewide about 4.1%. So it's pretty stable under the Measure 50, even in a recessionary climate. Multnomah County, however, values grew only 1.5%. Because you can have a fair number of industrial properties that are at the Measure 5 limits, market value. And if that property declines in value because of market forces, then you're going to see a drop in assessed value in that area. And we've seen that in some specific areas, but statewide, 4% growth, even in a recessionary environment. Also notice, of course, in contrast, what's going on here with the income tax. Growth here in the neighborhood of 10% a year. So, and keep in mind that the inflation in the 90s was about 3% a year. So a lot of this was real growth above the inflation rate in the income tax. Virtually none of it had to do, well, none of it had to do with policy changes. Actually, the policy in place, the kicker, the court decision on removing federal pension income from the base, they would have slowed this growth down. So it would have been even faster without those policy changes. You can see also very dramatically, here's last year dropping 17% here. And then the expectation that we're going to return back to some long-term growth. I'll talk a good deal about that in a minute. But I think the other message, of course, here is that not only do you have these two revenue sources swapping places, but you have two levels of government now swapping their relative role in the financial system. The state now becoming the predominant force in financing services, and local governments, and particularly schools, taking a secondary role. And that's probably the biggest change the legislature's had to deal with over the last decade. And you're still wrestling with the implications of that. One of the things that we like to do is stand back and look at Oregon's system with the census data. The census data gives us a comparison with other states, some consistent definitions, and it gives us everything. One of the biggest problems we have as a revenue office is getting current, up-to-date information on all the local governments we have out there. So we don't have anything summed up. The census sums that all up for us, and the 99-2000 fiscal year numbers we just got before Christmas, we put those in, and you can see those numbers. These are also in your public finance basic facts packet as well. But you can see the search for alternative revenue, as I termed it before, what happened in the system. Here's taxes dropping from 54% of general revenue, and the census definition of general revenue is everything except trust fund revenue and revenue from government enterprises. So in Oregon's case, trust fund revenue is public employee retirement system, workers' compensation trust fund, unemployment trust fund, government enterprises or any publicly owned utilities, OLCC, those are things that are pulled out. Everything else is in this general revenue category. So this is what's referred to here by general revenue, very broad category. And it gets, census definition puts it in four of these categories: taxes, federal money, charges, and miscellaneous. And if you look at taxes, you can see we went from 54% of revenue to 45% in the 90s. So that 10-year period, we're pulling away from taxes as a source of revenue in the system directly attributable to the property tax limits. Notice our federal share here is jumping from 20 to 25%, and now, when you compare us with these U.S. averages, very heavily dependent on federal revenue. And some of that, clearly, is a good portion of it was conscious policy here in this building to try to leverage federal dollars through the budget process, try to substitute some of the losses associated with the property tax initiative. Also notice at the state and local levels, we've seen an increased use in charges. State level, the most obvious one is tuition that we've used to backfill what was previously funded by tax dollars.
Question, John?
Well, you know, I've listened to the debate about Oregon's tax burden for state and local taxes is 46th in the country. Other people come and say yes, but our per capita government is eighth largest, and that disparity is because of the federal revenues that we receive. And I guess I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit more about what are those federal revenues. Where do those monies go? Is it health care matches, or what is it?
Senator, we have, the discrepancy between spending and taxes are a combination of these things, but you're right, federal is the one that stands out the most. Predominantly federal dollars, and we've got pretty detailed breakdown. The federal government produces, actually even broader than governments, it produces a report annually on per capita spending by state. And that would give you some comparisons. I'll get that report for you, because that is an annual report that's pretty much up to date.
Per capita spending of federal dollars by state.
Of federal dollars. Not only just, this is just state and local government here.
Yeah.
Oregon doesn't rank nearly as high when you include all federal dollars, such as defense and Social Security and those kind of things. But we do have that detailed breakdown. In terms of the state, the predominant area has been in human services.
And is that just because we're better at getting matching dollars than other states?
Well, matching dollars are important because we can spend in those areas where we know we get the match. And that's been a conscious policy.
Right.
There's also transportation dollars are significant.
Mm-hmm.
We do have more natural resource dollars because of the fact that we're 50% owned by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some categories like that. But the growth over the last 10 years, I would say offhand, and I'll make sure I can support that with evidence, but I think the growth has predominantly been in human resources.
And in the special sessions, in the budget reconciliation, did we affect that federal flow negatively and to a substantial level by some of the cuts that we made?
Mr. Chair, there was some negative effect, and that's just unavoidable. If you look at the House Bill 5100 and the cuts associated with that, there is a loss in human resource federal aid, I believe, as much as $70 million. That's associated with those reductions. So in the short term, it becomes very difficult to avoid that. If you're going to make any reductions, particularly in the healthcare area or other human resource areas, you get that matching effect. The other category here, here's the charges. You can see the increased use here. The other category is miscellaneous, which dropped pretty dramatically nationally over this period because it's predominantly interest earnings. In Oregon, it didn't drop very much, and the reason for that is this category also includes lottery. Mm-hmm. And if you look at lottery revenue as a percent of our general revenue, Oregon ranks number one in the country. Oregon state and local revenue system now, if we do some rankings and look at some detail on the taxes, of course, you know, we've got a system now where our general revenue is much more dependent on these non-tax sources. Yet, our overall general revenue ranks relatively high at ninth, and this is reason why the spending level is high, because the general revenue is relatively high. But the tax burden now was 45th, and we just got the 99-2000 data and puts us 39th. And one thing to keep in mind about these numbers is this year, 99-2000. You know, this is hot off the press by census standards, but 99-2000 is the peak of the bubble. So that's when we were getting the peak amount of our capital gains revenue, and I'll show you the effect of that in a minute. So this number here is really overstated because of capital gains. It's really more like about 4.3 on personal. Our tax burden at 10.5%, national average 11.2 gives us a rank of 39. The same set of numbers in 1989-90, we were ranked 13th. Taxes as a percent of income prior to Measure 5. Personal income, of course.
This only question it begs is the move from 45th to 39th is as much a reflection of changes in other states' tax policies or in ours?
Senator, there's really a couple of things. It's a combination of the categories, but I think on the personal side, the biggest factor, and of course anything on the personal side exaggerates our total because we're so dependent on it, was the capital gains. And you know, we didn't get any more capital gains than any other state, but we got more revenue from it because we're so dependent on the income tax. So our income tax burden was affected. Corporate also rose that year. And of course on corporate, it's so dependent on just a few firms. And some of our bigger firms had a relatively profitable year, and it rose in relative terms. Property rose a little bit too, because you did see some bump up in the use of particularly bonds that were taking place in the last 2 years. You'll see that when you look at the property tax data.
Okay, thanks.
Of course, the other component here is the sales, and when I say sales here, I'm including selective sales taxes like gasoline, cigarette, beer and wine. And even when you do that, include those and compare us with the other non-retail sales tax state, we still have the lowest consumption burden, still ranked 50th. The other states, by the way, are Alaska, Montana, Delaware, and New Hampshire, the other four non-retail sales tax states. Property, of course, the biggest change of the 90s, we went from a high property tax state, ranked 5th, to an average property tax state. Now we're right in the middle with these data. We have, and I'd mentioned this in our orientation, that we have the ability to try through our economic model to share out the tax burden through what we call the true incidence. And our economic model adjusts prices and employment and overall economic activity to reflect the state's tax system. And what we've done is share out that tax burden, and you can see if you look at the distribution of the tax burden, it's pretty much proportional, with the high end paying about the same as the low end. You do have this regressive tail here in which the tax rate rises as income falls, or opposite of that, it falls as income rises through these lower groups. This is due to this big green bar here, which is property tax. Property tax has a regressive tail, or we call a J-shaped distribution, because of the renter portion, the commercial property portion, which OTIM assumes is passed on to consumers. When you go to McDonald's and buy a burger, property tax is reflected in the price of that burger. And the other component here is the elderly have a high home ownership ratio, yet they tend to have low current income. So it's those three components that comprise that regressive tail here. But then you can see once we get beyond the lower income ranges, this slow, not a real rapid rate of progressivity here, because we only have the 5, 7, and 9 brackets. But you can see that begins to take over and finally pushes up the overall curve and gives you this kind of bowl-shaped distribution. If you look at most states, and the most exaggerated one to look at would be Washington, Washington's distribution would look like this. It would just be a straight negative function, regressive across the income spectrum because of its exclusive dependence almost on the sales tax. So Oregon's relatively unique to have a proportional system. Most systems tend to be regressive at the state and local level. Now, looking at the general fund and what happened in the 1990s is, you know, leading up to our current situation, you can see general fund resources tied to the income tax, 90% personal and corporate income taxes, growing about 112% for the decade. I do have, by the way, in your public finance packet, I have a page with all the budgets, all funds budget, general fund budget, revenue and expenditures going back the last five biennia. So that sometimes can come in handy to look at changes. Then the blue bar is personal income, a very good decade for the economy. Personal income increased over 80%, well above the inflation rate. Inflation rate was down here at about 32%. And then here's population growing 18%. So general fund revenue growth, very strong. And, of course, you see people refer to general fund and point out that it grew rapidly in the period and spending grew rapidly. And, of course, all that's true because those income tax revenues were increasing rapidly.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Parkin?
If you go back to that previous slide, if you stack the population on the CPI, although it's still a little bit lower than personal income, it really diminishes the increase relative to those two.
This would be, you know, this would be about 50%, and this is about 80%. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our real growth here was about 1.5 to 2% a year, real per capita, which is extraordinarily strong.
Mm-hmm.
Very unusual to see that kind of growth. So, you know, it really, in a lot of ways, is the best decade we've had. I mean, in terms of growth, the best decade we've had since the 40s, when we had all the growth during the war.
Yeah, this explains the, you know, the Gary George mythology about the massive growth of state government without taking into account the other elements, you know.
Well, so the natural question is, where did the money go? You have this explosive growth.
The dollars on the general fund side went to three areas, which account for over 90% of the general fund now. K through 12 education, public safety through Measure 11, doubling the inmate population size over that period, and through human resources, primarily through the Oregon Health Plan.
So those three accounted for 90% of the growth in the 90s.
Yes. And of course, the increase on the K through 12 was not necessarily a net increase because same time general funds going up, property tax dollars are falling.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some more detailed look. In fact, we've asked Echo Northwest through Oregon School Boards Association to come in and talk to you about a report they've done looking at per student spending over the last decade and looking at a whole bunch of different measures and give you kind of a sense of what's gone on there and why you hear a lot of different things, and some of which are, many of which are true, even though they appear to be contradictory. It depends on the measure. I remember when I came back to the Northwest in 1989 and began forecasting revenue, I really didn't pay much attention to capital gains. It wasn't a big deal. It was roughly around $1 billion a year, been about there throughout the last decade. It wasn't something that explained much variation. But you can see that in the 90s, gets up to $2 billion here, stays around $2 billion, and then just explodes in the late 90s all the way up to $6 billion.
You could rename that the PERS crisis slide.
No, these gains were showing up in those PERS accounts as real increases, and when they turned out to be paper increases, as we've seen with the decline. But this is the amount of capital gains realized reported on Oregon tax returns. So people had sold these stock predominantly, about three-fourths stock, had sold the stock and reported the income on their taxes. And so that means they're paying here about 9%, because they're most all in that top 9% bracket. One of the things that I did to try to get a sense of, well, gee, what did this mean for our budget, our general fund budget, was to go back and estimate an average in the 1980s as a percent of income. So I took capital gains in that period, and you know, the 80s were not a bad decade for the stock market. The bull market really started in 1982, and we had pretty significant gains throughout the period. But you can see that the gains reported on returns hovered right around the long-term average here. So we were, you know, a net. We had some gains here in the late 80s, but not much. By the mid-90s, that began to increase above that trend, and so by 99-01, we had $670 million in general fund money that was directly attributable to the stock market bubble. capital gains above its long-term trend. So that's 670 of your roughly $10 billion in revenue. And look at some states like California, this percentage is even higher. The other thing related to that gain was what was going on in corporate profits. Corporate profits had not grown much prior to the early 90s. If you look at a fiscal year data, and we've got a chart on there that tracks every year in your public finance document, 79.80 was a peak back here. We didn't reach that 79.80 level again until 92.93. So we had roughly a 15-year period before we got back up to that level in corporate income tax. Well, you can see what happened in the 90s. It jumped from about $300 million biennium to $700 million, so more than doubled in that period. And of course, this is when we were sending back big kicker refunds the following biennium. So this all has the kicker refunds in it. It would have been more without the kicker refunds. And you can see in 99.01, we're seeing some recovery from 97.99 to a relatively high level here, and that census data is what's picking this up. Now, the revenue crunch. There's a couple of things that I think have been particularly difficult for your constituents to get a sense on the revenue side is that, well, sure, this is a recession. It's painful, but historically, in terms of job losses, it's mild compared to what we saw in the early 80s. And that has to do with the income sources, and I'll show you that in a minute, where those revenue losses have occurred. I think a lot of that has to do with how the structure of the economy has changed. And actually, I think in a positive way, but in terms of the revenue stream, it's made it more volatile. General fund revenue, the declines we've seen are unprecedented in the post-war period. The 17% drop last fiscal year was the biggest drop we've had. If you look at some of the NCSL publications, biggest drop in state revenue since the post-war period, state revenue combined for all states. Federal government saw a drop in its revenue, which is income tax related, 6% last fiscal year, their biggest drop of the post-war period. So the issue is why the disconnect, and I think it has to do with the structure of the economy, and a lot of it has to do with that stock market bubble. Here's the employment numbers, and this is from your revenue forecast material, but you can see here's the early 80s, and I think you all remember the economic damage done by the national recession at that time. Job loss is around 10% over the period, statewide job losses. Here's the mild 1991 recession, which was just a blip in our revenue stream. But here's the 01-02 recession, more severe than this, but nowhere near as severe in terms of employment as the early 80s. Well, on the revenue side, you look at 01-02, here's what the state economist was telling you back in the spring of 01, saying, well, the economy's flattening out. We think the stock market's going to flatten out. Not much job growth. So we're going to see pretty much a flat revenue stream here between the last year of last biennium and the first year of this biennium. And here's what happened. A 17.4% drop on a year-to-year basis. And that was 18% below the May 2001 forecast that you used to build your 0103 budget on. And, of course, that's why you've been in special session five times. If you look at the components, kind of gives you a sense of how the economy has changed and where is those losses coming from. Wages and salaries very rarely drop in a recession. They usually don't keep up with inflation, but they very rarely drop. And you can see that of the $910 million drop in the first fiscal year of this biennium, 81 of it came from wages. One of the things we think is happening is that the way workers are paid, particularly high-tech workers, reliance on bonuses, for example, you tend to see less layoffs there, but what you see are those bonuses not paid out, and the state doesn't get its 9% cut. And that's where we're seeing the immediate response there. Now, in a way, from an economist's standpoint, that's probably good. You'd rather see wage adjustments than layoffs because it's stabilizing for the economy. But in terms of revenue, it may actually be more destabilizing. If you look at the other component here is per capita capital gains. dropped by $231 million. That's the taxes off capital gains. It's a 54% drop from the prior year. This other income tax revenue, this is predominantly business income. It includes proprietorships, partnerships, it could be consultants, it could be subchapter S corporations are in this component. So this is predominantly business income. The other component here, pension and kicker refunds, well, this was policy. The kicker refunds were based on the prior biennium, and that was in current law at that time. Now it's in the Constitution. And the pension refunds were due to a court case. So we knew those losses were going to happen. Corporate dropped $178 million. That's actually a 47% decline. Corporate revenue. So we can see one of the things that the legislature has given us authority to do, the revenue office, is to look at individual returns, which we do to try to explain these kind of drops. We can't talk publicly about the companies, but it is striking that some of the biggest corporate taxpayers that have generated that revenue growth in the past, how much their contributions have fallen off because they're not profitable. Remember, it's not a size issue. If you're not profitable, then you don't owe corporate income taxes. And, of course, a lot of corporations have been experiencing losses in recent years.
Is that across sectors, or is it primarily high-tech? Or
Mr. Chair, Elizabeth, in her presentation tomorrow, has a good chart from the Revenue Department. They've been keeping track of all the sectors, withholding payments coming from the sectors. And you can where you really see it is manufacturing is what's really dropped off. And you can see things like health services have held up pretty stable. But it's manufacturing predominantly where we've seen the huge losses, both in corporate income taxes and in withholding receipts, because that's where the layoffs have happened. That's who's been hit by the recession, really across the state. This other revenue here is the $99 million that the 01 legislature put in the general fund from the tobacco settlement, creating any balance. Now, if you look at the current projection now and where the Office of Economic Analysis is estimating we are with, 6 months to go in the biennium, looking at a drop of 8.4% relative to the 99.01 level. So you can see after a steady increase throughout the decade, we're going to drop 8% here in dollars collected. You can also see what's happened with corporate revenue. This is just taking that other chart and adding one more bar to it. And the 0103 bar, which is down here close to where we were in the early 90s. Of course, from a forecaster's standpoint, what you're looking at here is saying, well, what's normal here? Is this just an aberration due to the recession and then we'll return to some of these taller peaks? Or is this a long-term phenomenon? The corporate profits are going to be depressed for an extended period. That becomes a difficult call. What you'll tend to see on the forecast is something in between these two.
Mr. Chair.
Somewhere in there.
Senator Corker.
And your call is?
Senator, I remind you that I don't do that anymore.
If we gave you like 5% extra or something, would you mind?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Starr. Senator Farrell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Shouldn't we really look at the period from 1993 to 1999 as being the anomalous period and look at the 91 to 94 or 93 projections as being far more representative of the economy without the overheated stock market economy? And I think the tendency is to hope and wish and dream and kind of wishful think ourselves back into that period of revenue that follows the 93 to 99 bubble. But I don't know any analysts that are talking about that being possible. And I'm wondering if the forecasters that are operating for our revenue forecasting don't have a tendency to want to live in the averages between the 2003 and the 99 numbers. And I don't think that's reasonable.
Senator, I think you can make a strong case that the mid-90s were average. I'm certainly on the stock market, both on the upside, now on the downside. I mean, if you look at the last 3 years, the Dow has declined. Well, that hadn't happened since 39, 40, and 41. So, I mean, now we're seeing kind of the other extreme there. And so what's normal? You're right. Forecasters tend to say it is somewhere in the averages. But there are some positives out there in this economy. One of the things that we continue to see in the national numbers is gains in productivity. I mean, that has to be positive. That's positive in terms of real wages, positive in terms of international competitive position. Yet some other things that we saw in the 90s, you know, that have been related to the stock market gains, particularly the revenue side and the corporate profit growth, probably are anomalous and probably aren't going to return. So I think there's reasons to think the economy will begin growing again, but I don't think we're going to see these kinds of numbers again. I think
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to say that, you know, the joke about economists is that I have three hands because they give you one view and then another view, and then on the other hand, there's another view. The productivity gains mean less employment. And in a service economy, that means fewer jobs and less income. The productivity gains that we're seeing now, people are running harder to keep the same market share. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the unit costs are factored in and the profit per unit is less. So the productivity gains are tending to be eroded just in terms of the competitiveness of global markets. And so what I guess I'm looking at these anomalous numbers. I think they're anomalies. The 90s bubble. You know, it's like toss out the high and low and look at what's in the middle. And don't get too optimistic because productivity gains and the fact that employment's not eroding as fast as it was in Oregon doesn't signal a turnaround. Maybe it just talks about we're starting to skid to the bottom. Unless the rest of the country, including the California economy, starts to turn around and signal real strength, I don't see Oregon's economy starting to heat up. I guess I'll wait
Senator,
for the Eco Northwest for
prognostications. That's very possible. But I can also tell you that I remember talking to revenue committees back in 91. When the 1991 recession was going on. I remember the Jack Ward Thomas report and the reductions in the federal timber harvest. You know, we were very concerned about the state economy at that time, and I thought rightfully so. We had some real good evidence to think there was going to be some major problems. Yet we still had a very strong decade. So, you know, it is very difficult to anticipate, you know, what's going to drive growth. But I think that your perspective on these financial-related revenue streams, which would be corporate income tax, capital gains, those I don't think we'll see for another generation, if then.
Paul, do you know, and you may have not had a chance to analyze the governor's budget, but does he, and it's not a specific number, does he take the middle approach of his revenue projections?
We do have a discussion. We will have the state economists come in, Mr. Chair, and kind of talk about their methodology. House Revenue Chair Shetterly has asked me to do a review of the revenue forecast system, and I'll provide that for you next week. But their role is to provide a midpoint, mid-level estimate. You know, that's been their role since that office was created in 1980. Senator Farioli's right. I mean, the tendency is to go towards some long-term average. So when we have good times like the mid-90s, we tend to underestimate. And when we have difficult periods like the early 80s and now in the early 2000s, we tend to overshoot on the revenue stream side. But their job, at least it's always been interpreted, I think in this building, their job is to provide you with an unbiased estimate so that you can feel confident that nobody knows the future, but they're going to give you an estimate that's not going to be tilted one way or another.
Intentionally.
If you look at the tax collections for all the states, and look at this is on a national basis, the sum of all of them. And you can also kind of think what's going on here in terms of the revenue forecast for the 0103, for the 01 session. This light blue bar is income taxes. And year over year, they grew 10% first quarter of 01. here's the second quarter of 2002, returns coming in, you're picking up that last good year of capital gains based on 2000 tax year. And you can see that nationally, income taxes were up about 8%. But you can also see some of the evidence of slowing overall revenue here. And probably in hindsight, looks like a real harbinger of what was to lie ahead, corporate revenue is starting to drop off. The most sensitive of the revenue streams turned sharply negative in the early part of 2001. And this is actually technically when the recession began. It was in March of 2001. So now as we go through into this current biennium, you can see what's happened. Third quarter dollars for personal income tax collections turned negative for the first time. That's the first time they had turned negative in a decade. Well, what happens? September forecast comes out, you got a projected deficit. They continue to be negative, and then they get very corporate gets extremely negative here, minus 30%. Oregon's in this fourth quarter was minus 70%. And you can see as we go into the spring here, we're looking at these tax returns coming in, and the first quarter of 2002, second quarter of 2002, nationally, income tax collections are down 22%. And then you get the June forecast. It shows a $500 million reduction. So you can also see that things are starting to flatten out. But remember, now we're starting to compare, instead of with these high growth periods, we're starting to compare with this year earlier when things had already started to decline. So we're coming off of a bottom there. But also notice that personal is still negative. One of the things that happens on these quarterly returns is you have people making estimated payments, and many of them just use a safe harbor approach where they pay based on what they paid last year. And so they were overpaying when things turned bad in the first part of 2001, but now their payments are reflecting what they paid last year, realizing their liability's gone down because their income's gone down. The other thing to notice about this chart is the sales tax. Now, we think the sales tax is in theory a more stable revenue source because it has only one rate. You know, you tax everything at 5% or 6% or whatever, whereas the income tax will have progressive rates. So when you lose revenue, such as we're doing now, you're losing most of it at a 9% rate, a high disproportionate amount of it. The other thing is, in a recession, you tend to see consumers will take some out of savings, so they'll reduce their consumption by a lower percentage than they do their overall income. Now, that can vary with the sales tax base. The more you rely on volatile components like business equipment or consumer durables, then the more volatile your sales tax base will be. But in this recession, we've had a situation where consumption has held up very well, and that's predominantly because of low interest rates. Low interest rates have kept the housing market strong and the automobile market, and that's where a lot of sales taxes are associated with that. So the sales tax states have not been hit as hard. Now, it doesn't mean they haven't been hit. Washington has a budget deficit, too. But the sales tax states have not been hit as hard as the income tax states in this recession. And, of course, if you look at, gee, who's affected by that? Well, the dependence on this estate tax collections, the census data again for 2000-2001, Oregon at 74% is the most dependent on the income tax, and indeed more dependent on a single tax than any other state is on any other source. Washington second with the sales tax. By the way, the census rolls up Washington's business and occupation tax as a sales tax, adds it to that. The other for Alaska is severance taxes. I've got an old classmate of mine whose job it is to forecast those revenues, and I don't envy him because that's extremely volatile depending on what happens to the world at all. Just a rehash of the budget response, and of course, I think you have to keep coming back to this for your decisions ahead for 2003-2005 is that one-time revenue was $685 million, including transfer from the new Education Stability Fund, some other sources that are one-time in nature, use of MUPL money, for example, tobacco settlement money, things that won't be there in 2003-2005, our accounting adjustment, the accrual allowed to school districts. Temporary revenue is the phase-in of Measure 88. And the permanent revenue, the main thing here, is the Measure 20. Cigarette tax increase. So there's $919 million in cuts, including the rebalance from caseload adjustments. And then, of course, the $310 in the balance right now, we'll find out in about 10 days whether that'll be restored or not. This projected deficit, Governor Kitzhaber, before he left office, did make administrative across-the-board reductions to rebalance with the 112. So you can actually add this 112 back up to the expenditure reductions to get roughly $1 billion.
And what are you forecasting on the $310 million for next Tuesday?
Mr. Chair, I'm forecasting next Tuesday will be partly cloudy. So, no, those, remember those, in all the governor's budget and the revenue forecast material and so forth, this is all current law. So that's in, those in all those budgets, and if Measure 28 passes, then that law is suspended. So the 310 goes away. So looking ahead to the 2003-2005 revenue situation, the economic outlook, talk a little bit about that, how revenue will respond, and then, of course, the expenditures, and I also think it's important to recognize when you look at, and I'll show you a chart on the beginning balance and how that affects things, but what happens typically, whether you're on the upside or the downside, your revenues are out ahead of your expenditures. So when revenues come in short, it tends to take two biennia to adjust the budget. And that's, you're in the second year of that process, even if revenues stabilize. This is the December forecast. Again, the state economist will go through all of this with you and the underlying assumptions he's made. But the key point here is that the assumption is the recovery is going to be underway. Basically is now. We are seeing year-over-year gains in statewide employment. That Oregon will return to a higher growth state than the national average. Most of this is based on regional projections. The West just tends to be a stronger region than the rest of the country. That's our primary market. We tend to get more in-migration, particularly from California. But nowhere near the kind of growth we saw out in this area. And you can see the recovery we had from 91 is when we went into really boom stage here in the mid-90s with the high-tech investment. The growth rate that's being assumed in the governor's budget is underlying economic growth. This is 18%. And if you looked at, watched a little bit of Ways and Means Committee discussion yesterday, the 18% is the underlying assumption here. But really, I think the more important number for you to think about and still be cautious about, though, is the 13.6. Because these numbers in this prior biennium are artificially low because of the kicker. So you know that's not going to happen next time. So if you adjust for the kicker, adjust for the last payout of the federal pension case, you get 13.6 growth, which is right about dead even with the long-term average.
Mr. Chair?
Secretary?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that the kicker could kick even in this recessionary time, correct?
Senator, now remember that the kicker, you're right, that the kicker can be triggered under any conditions because it's not so much, you know, it's the actual compared to what the state economists predicted. If the state economists predicted a severe recession and we had a mild recession, you could still have a kicker. But it also goes back to the date, and the timing of this becomes very important.
So it is the May...
It's the May of 2001 forecast.
That doesn't change at all. I was thinking that the further assumptions.
What you will have now, you know, one of the things that has made your budget situation more difficult to manage is the timing of it, because you really had the forecast had not declined at all. It's actually, I think, up a little bit in May, and it had been pretty much steady increase. You had a kicker refund going out, and soon as the biennium began, the first forecast was down.
Right.
You've had six in a row down each time.
So it is improbable. It's impossible to kick with it.
You'd have to make up that $2 billion.
Yeah. Or
about $2 billion short of the threshold. So it's not going to happen. But it does, you know, you get the cyclical timing now. You're doing a May 03 forecast right at the bottom, and then you get a little bit more strength. But I think what, you know, certainly the sense I had from the Ways and Means Committee yesterday is, there's a lot of skepticism about the 13.6. And that, of course, is natural, given what you've just gone through for the last 2 years. And 13.6 is the long-term average. and some of the things that Senator Farioli was talking about, you know, if indeed we are in a slower growth period, the 13.6 may not be attainable. So you've got the point is you have significant downside risk as well as upside risk. And what they're trying to do, and their job is to try to give you something that has equal upside and downside risk. But I think it's important to keep in mind, based on this experience and this experience, that the variation, the variability, is really a lot wider than we thought it was, say, 10 years ago.
Senator Ringo.
Paul, you said that 13% is our long-term average. But Senator Farioli points out that the long-term average, if we focus in the 90s, if that's an aberration. And so how long-term are you talking about? That's a long-term average over what period of time?
The 13.6 goes back to 79-81. That's really the basis for it.
If you were to throw out the 90s, then as an aberration, then the long-term average would be more like 6%, 5%?
I think we'd be more like 10%.
Okay.
You know, the reason why you start from the early 80s is because that was when we first went to our current inflation environment. Okay. You go back to the 70s, general fund was increasing 40%.
Yeah.
Of course, most of it was eaten away by inflation.
Yeah.
So those numbers we've tended to throw out, and maybe we'll end up at some point throwing these out too.
Okay,
but we do have a similar kind of inflation environment in these two periods.
I mean, you could go back to the 70s or 60s as long as you indexed it for inflation. It would still be a useful measurement.
Yes, it would. You'd have to index for inflation. But inflation, plays some significant effect on the variations in revenue growth, particularly back in the 70s because you had a lot of bracket creep going on as well because the system wasn't indexed. Well, now, of course, we've gone to an indexed bracket, even though we don't have as many brackets.
Senator Farioli.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with the methodology, but I think there's a caveat for Senator Rango's observation, and that is that the economy is fundamentally different than it was in 1916-70. So you're looking at comparing a revenue stream average against economies that are fundamentally different structurally. So, you know, you think you're comparing on an adjusted curve, but you may as well be looking at different countries. You know, we're structurally and fundamentally changed from an agriculturally and forest products dependent economy in the 60s to high-tech manufacturing in the 70s or 90s. And they just are, they're just not comparable.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get the statistical averages that look like they work, but when you're looking at those structures, they're not the same.
And I think that Senator Farioli's point gets back to what I said earlier about how the way economy rewards factors of production are different, how people are paid, how their wages are different, how businesses are paid. We see more tendency to tie directly to current production and current incentives, and that's going to add some instability. If you look at the revenue forecast, and one of the things I know the governor hasn't presented any current service budget, and that's something that I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with in the current environment. But you can kind of get a sense of what's happening if you go back to 99-01 revenue and let that grow 6% a year. That puts you at this trend bar. And the 01-03, even though you've got that 13.6% growth, you don't ever catch up with that trend. So you're looking at a lot of cost stuff, like medical costs, for example, that are driving some of your budgets, and those are growing out here, and this is your revenue stream, even with the recovery. And that's where the pressure is going to come on the Ways and Means Committee to adjust the budget. My final overhead gets back to the point about the role of the beginning balance and how that affects how much revenue you have to budget in the general fund. We talk about revenue, and you can see here's the revenue growth, here's the 13.6%, 18% really between these two numbers. But a as I said before, there's always this lag on when spending catches up with revenue. And if you get more revenue than you project, you end up with a big beginning balance. The kicker affects revenue in the next biennium. If you get more than you expect, it flows into the beginning balance. So you're coming into the 97 legislature, building their budget off the 95-97 boom. They've got $800 million in the bank before they start. And even the last two biennium, even the 01 legislature, had $363 million as a beginning balance. Okay, so that you add to the revenue becomes your resources, become what's available to budget. Now, if you look at that number and make a distinction between what's going on now, where the $21 million is a projected ending balance, assuming the revenue forecast holds up, then instead of getting this 18% growth here, you've got between these two biennia about 4% growth between 99-01 and 03-05, and your service level is still largely tied to this 99-01 level because of one-time revenues that were used to try to retain that level. So that gives you a sense of kind of what the general fund resource picture looks like, even with an economic recovery. Again, the economic recovery is definitely not certain.
Thank you, Paul. Questions? Can you give us a preview of tomorrow?
Tomorrow, Mr. Chair, we'll focus on the personal income tax. So Elizabeth will go through. She'll focus a lot on some of these different components of adjusted gross income and how they performed over the 90s and how they performed in the recession. And I think we'll explore a lot more this volatility issue on the personal income tax. And she's got she'll walk through all of that with you, talk a lot about the federal connection issues that you'll have to deal with in this session. Kind of talk about the administrative structure of the personal income tax. You've already gotten a number of bills that deal with that from Department of Revenue and other sources.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're adjourned. We will meet promptly at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Folks can make it on time. That's great.
We've had two meetings that we haven't.